Speak. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We call our third case for the day. 2004 AP 1092 CR, State v. Taylor. Martha Askins, Assistant State Public Defender, arguing for Mr. Taylor.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. My name is Martha Askins. I'm an attorney with the State Public Defender's Office, and I represent the defendant in this case, Jermaine Taylor. I'm asking the Court to hold today that the sentence imposed in this case, 12 years of confinement, 6 years of extended supervision, is excessive. This case presents an opportunity for the Court to clarify and modify sentencing case law in Wisconsin. I would ask the Court to do the following. One, clarify that we have different lines of inquiry in sentencing. There is the Galleon line of cases where the trial court does not explain the sentence imposed, and then there is the line of cases where the sentence itself is error. This case falls into both categories. I submit that the trial court did not explain its sentence pursuant to Galleon and, of course, McCleary.
Wasn't this pre-Galleon?
This was pre-Galleon, Your Honor. And actually, that raises a question about whether Galleon actually changed McCleary. Obviously, the Court said in Galleon that it was reinvigorating McCleary. Whether it changed it or not, I think, is subject to some debate, and I would say that the Court of Appeals, in my experience, views it as not much of a change at all. I would also ask the Court to clarify that an excessive sentence in Wisconsin is not the same as an unconstitutional sentence. That is, the shocks the conscience standard that we have in Wisconsin derives from a constitutional line of cases, and this Court should clarify that under McCleary, a sentence can be excessive without being unconstitutional. I would ask the Court to clarify that a sentence well within the maximum limits is not always valid. And in that, I'm referring to State v. Grindemann. I would ask the Court to clarify that standard. I would ask the Court to reemphasize what this Court said in Tuttle, which is that the appellate court has the authority of discretionary reversal to do justice in individual cases, and that this authority includes the power to reverse sentencing decisions. Referencing Galleon, this case presents an opportunity for the Court to clarify what it said in Galleon. In other words, did Galleon change what trial courts must do at sentencing or not?
Why do we care?
Excuse me?
Why do you care whether it changed it or not? Just read it. I mean, what difference does it make?
Well, I think what difference it makes is that parties and judges need to know what's expected at the time of sentencing. And I guess the reason I care is that when I review a case in my job and I review a sentencing, I would like to know what the trial judge must do at the time of sentencing in order to have a valid sentence. And in my review of cases, it seems to me that under our case law now, and what should be made crystal clear, is that at least two things are required. One is that the Court explain how the Court arrives at the number that it arrived at, that is, state the reasons, And secondly, that the court impose a sentence that is fair and that is just. And it's the fairness and the justness of the sentence that I think this case presents as an opportunity for this court. Finally, this case, I believe, offers an opportunity to discuss further the standard of review for sentencing. Now, I guess an obvious question in this case is, since I'm saying that Jermaine Taylor's sentence is excessive, what do I mean by that? What is an excessive sentence? And I would offer two definitions that are pretty close, I think, that are alternate ways of saying essentially the same thing. One, and I draw this language from the discretionary reversal statute, one would be a sentence is excessive when its terms undermine the interests of justice. The second, I take borrowing from excessive punitive damages cases in reviewing what the language is when courts have found that punitive damages have been excessive. I would offer this standard. An excessive sentence is one which is more than necessary to serve its identified purposes or which inflicts a penalty which is disproportionate to the defendant's character or to his wrongdoing. I would offer those as definitions of what a sentence or what an excessive sentence is.
All right. Having said that, it undermines the interest of justice and punitive, and then go to punitive. What? Go through this sentence, and this was a sentence that there was a pre-sentence that recommended 6 and 6.
Correct.
And the judge misspoke, brought it back on a, it was brought back on a motion for reconsideration, and imposed 12 and 6. So that we're talking about basically 6 years, the difference of 6 years here. The maximum, which the court always would look at, was either, I think it was either 30 or 40 years.
It was 30. This would be a Tiswan case.
And so this was, when you look at things, this was roughly one-third. I hate to do that. One-third would have been 36. But let's say it was of the maximum, which is now you're going to address Grindemann, which kind of comes in there. But the idea of undermining the interest of justice, looking at this case, which involves a person who was on probation, as I understand it, offended at least twice while on probation, and let's say showed a lack of remorse, perhaps, and the question of rehabilitation. So that's what I want you to address.
Well, let me back up to the maximum penalty, first of all. This was a TIS-1 case. It had a 30-year maximum. However, as we know, that had to be bifurcated, and the maximum confinement would have been 20 years at that time. So the 12 years of confinement that was imposed was more than half.
Right.
Secondly, you're right, Justice Wilcox. What happened was the pre-sentence report recommended a total of 12 years with 6 in confinement and 6 in extended supervision. And I was post-conviction counsel as well. When I read the sentencing transcript, it appeared to me that the court maybe misread the pre-sentence recommendation because the judge made reference to 18 years instead of 12. And so that was part of the basis for going back before the court on post-conviction for post-conviction relief. I think the sentence is too excessive for a number of reasons.
Well, before you go there,
okay.
If I can take you back to your definitions, because you cited as definition number 2, a standard that you took from, say, punitive damages. Why not just use the standard that's set forth in McCleary and in Neely, where the court quoted with approval the American Bar Association Project on Minimum Standards for Criminal Justice and stated, quote, the sentence imposed in each case should call for the minimum amount of custody or confinement which is consistent with the protection of the public, the gravity of the offense, and the rehabilitative needs of the defendant. Why not just stick with what the court's already said?
Well, I think we could do that. And I think that what I've tried to do, or what I have tried to do, is rephrase the ABA standard into a slightly different terminology. Because we know that for a long time, courts have had to consider those three factors that are identified in the ABA standards and have also understood that the least amount of confinement should be imposed in every case. And yet, although that was stated in McCleary, that seems to not be the practice of trial courts in this state. When we read sentencing transcripts, and obviously, you know, a number of judges here were trial judges, it does not appear to me that trial judges have been as rigorous as they could be and that the parties have not been as rigorous as they could be in making their sentencing arguments. That, in fact, where we start is with probation. We start at that point and we move from there if probation is not adequate. So I would not disagree with the standard that's in the ABA standards. What I have attempted to do is rephrase that to make clear that the court means what it said. It means what it said in McCleary. It means what it said in Galleon. And we do embrace the ABA standards. We do require that level of rigor when it comes to the sentencing decision. Now, I anticipate that there would be some concern on the court's part that this would lead to a huge increase in appeals for the Court of Appeals and for this court as well. And I did address that somewhat in my brief, indicating that I think there will be a brief spike in appeals initially. And I think that that's true. However, I think in the long run, this adopting a more rigorous standard, a heightened level of scrutiny of sentencing decisions, would make virtually no difference in the statistics before this court and the Court of Appeals. And the reason I say that is that a large number of defendants appeal their cases because they are unhappy with the sentence. And if they are unhappy with the sentence, they may view an attack on the substance of the conviction, the merits of the conviction, is the only way to get where they want to be. So, for example, an individual who has pleaded guilty and is unhappy about his sentence, suddenly he's looking at a Bangor issue or some other substantive attack on his conviction. And we see that that's identified in McCleary, it's identified in Lefebvre, that what happens in reality is that defendants try to shoehorn in cases before the appellate courts when really their concern is the length of the sentence that was imposed. In terms of getting back to your question, Justice Wilcox, about Germain, and I did address this in my brief, it seems to me that this was clearly an immature young man, no question about it. If we knew what other similar offenders received as punishment, that might be useful information to have. We don't really have that information, at least I don't know how it could be easily accessed. We do know that other similar offenders are not prosecuted for this type of activity. Now, granted, in this case, we have aggravating factors.
Okay, I was going to say, now this is a person who you talk about, probation.
Right.
He was on probation. The offenses occurred when he was on probation.
Correct.
Multiple offenses.
Well, Let me clarify that. This offense is a criminal offense. The previous one, I'm not going to pretend the record is something that it's not. We have incident number one. Incident number two is a 17-year-old girl, and this case, Sarah, is 15. All right? So two is not a criminal offense that was charged. And if I could, Your Honor, the pre-sentence report, if we looked at the pre-sentence report in this case, which incorporates the first case, the case who was placed on probation, Jermaine was underage as well at that time. And in fact, reading between the lines in the pre-sentence report, I think it was Christina, was also charged in that offense. So, yes, he was charged. Yes, he should have known better. But the gravity of the situation may not have been made entirely clear to him at that time. Then incident or violation comes along, and he spends 60 days in jail. Yes, again, he should have realized the gravity of his conduct. And then we have this one. And I'm not saying that he should not be punished or that even he shouldn't have received consecutive time. But 12 years where he is going to spend his 20s and into his early 30s locked up in prison seems to me to be unjust for him and really for us in the community, that he is going to come back to our community having grown up in the institution. And I think that's where we get to looking at the sentence itself, and McCleary gives room for the opportunity for this court to say it's not a just sentence. And I think this was not a just sentence.
What is a just sentence here?
In this case, yeah. I would say, given that he had received a 5-year indeterminate term, that 3 consecutive would have been a fair sentence.
For a total of eight.
Now, the 5-year sentence.
He wouldn't have had a total of 8 because the 5-year sentence was indeterminate.
I was just
going to
say.
And he would be out in November of 06.
I was just going to add that. It's not a true 5-year sentence. He would either, presumably he could do to MR because that's a presumptive MR case. But if he behaved and did well in the institution and, say, did MR, or could be paroled to the determinate sentence. So those are things that the trial court knew about and had to factor in. I think 3 years of day for day, we're a long ways past paroling now. We're talking doing every single day in the institution. And I think 3 years for that young man would have been perhaps even more than the least amount of confinement necessary. I think as we read the transcripts, he did understand once he was sentenced to the Wisconsin State Prison System, he got the message pretty loud and clear that this was unacceptable.
Counsel, did you meet with Mr. Taylor?
I have known Mr. Taylor for a number of years because I had the probation case as well.
What kind of a person is he?
He's a young man. I mean, he's a kid to me, he's a kid. I talked to his mom. In the beginning, I think he didn't really understand that this was serious business. And as I have dealt with him, because I did have that earlier case and now I have this case, we've been, in touch with each other for a long time. And I think he has fortunately grown up a little bit. I'm glad and feel fortunate for him that he has done very well in the institution. He's now, when I first met him, he was at Green Bay. He's now at Oshkosh, so he's moved to a lower security institution. I believe he has his HSED, which is great. And I don't remember if he's also working, but, you know, it seems to me when I first met him was that he was a kid who didn't really understand the gravity of his situation. And he gets that now.
How is there any objective way to determine that he's gotten it other than your representation? I mean, it's my understanding that people who are charged with sexual offenses are often exceptionally well-behaved within the institution.
But this, he is not actually even being viewed in the institution as a, quote, sex offender. He is being viewed, I mean, he wasn't even recommended for sex offender treatment, and that was information that I presented to Judge Torhorst and Racine, that obviously wasn't persuasive to the court. He's not viewed as a sex offender in the institution. So he's different, although he'll have to go through the 980 evaluation and all of that. But he's different from, say, the 40-year-old. I mean, one of the reasons I think this sentence is excessive is when we compare, as I pointed out in my brief, we compare different offenders. You know, the conduct might be the same, but who is the offender? What's the character of the offender? And one of the big things going on here is that he is a young man, again, and from my point of view, a kid. He's not a 40-year-old client or a 40-year-old defendant who is having relationships with 14, 15-year-old girls. In many ways, this is kind of a peer-appropriate, although, you know, that's stretching it a little bit. But we're talking about a couple of teenagers. We're not talking about an adult with a kid. And so in many ways, I think it's pretty amazing how well he's done because he went in as, you know, as a teenager.
Counselor, wasn't the trial court impressed by the fact that this 15-year-old girl was given alcohol prior to the sexual encounter that occurred in Green Bay, and also by the fact that he got in contact with her and chastised her that it was her fault for getting him into trouble in regard to this incident?
Well, the judge mentioned the alcohol aspect of it. That's true. And the judge also mentioned, in fact, in rereading the pre-sentence report, it looked like the girl visited him at the jail while this thing was pending. I don't know if chastising her is the right word, but certainly they had contact with each other. And there's a reference in the record at some point that, you know, maybe if she didn't come forward or something like that, that this wouldn't have happened.
Well, there's a reference in the PSI in regard to her and her family hoping he'll just stay in jail, that this is the third time he's done this, and he said it was her fault for getting him into the trouble that he's in now, and her parents certainly see this much differently as just a couple of kids.
Right. I know the parents see this differently. And the parents have to be furious, of course, that Sarah got pregnant. There's no question about that. And I understand that if I were Sarah's parents, I might also say, I want this guy to sit the rest of his life in jail. But that's information for the judge to consider, of course, not information for the judge to simply adopt. And among the things that the judge would consider would be, for example, the pre-sentence report, which called for half the confinement time than the judge ultimately imposed. And yet the court didn't choose to explain how it is that we need to double the amount of confinement for this young man as opposed to what the pre-sentence writer had recommended.
Well, I think, and I'm looking at the state's brief on page 17 and also yours, that the judge obviously looked and considered the pre-sentence. He didn't I mean, it would be difficult for this Court to say, well, you have to explain why you're going to exceed every time if you exceed the pre-sentence and then you're looking at what the State does and what the defense recommends. But I just call to your attention that on page 17 of the red brief, there talk about the Court's sentencing rationale begin on page 13 and concludes at page 20. But in that same page, the judge is saying, as I read it, he doesn't realize the havoc he's created in the lives of three young women, three children, no father, no responsibility. He's out there essentially saying, give me another pass. The other concern, I think the judge said, was we had, as you mentioned, counsel, the alcohol consumption, the intimidation that may have well occurred, and the fact that there was some concern on the judge's part that if he didn't do something, that the community would be, let's see if I can get the exact words, endangered in some way from some more behavior of this type. And that's basically what happened here. I understand your argument because of the age. But you're saying, well, yes, he should have gotten three. The judge gave him 12. Judges have discretion. You know, as you mentioned, a lot of us have been on the trial bench. And it seems to me that the judge did take into consideration the very concerns that you're expressing here before he pronounced sentence.
Chief, my light's on. May I respond?
Go ahead. Yes. Of course.
Two things. First, the judge did give reasons for the sentence in this case. My argument is that the court failed to link the purpose of the sentence with the number of years he chose to impose. In every case, the judge shouldn't have to say, I'm doubling the pre-sentence report because. I wouldn't insist that that be a rule. However, where the judge gives reasons, the judge should then link those reasons to the number of years imposed. And that's what I thought Galleon required. And secondly, the other way of looking at this is that, yes, trial judges have discretion. They are out there on their own every day imposing sentences that are rarely, if ever, reviewed. They rarely, if ever, get guidance from this Court or the Court of Appeals on what makes a good sentencing. And I would ask this Court to take this opportunity to say, this is what we mean when we say, give reasons and impose a sentence that is just. And if we think a collegial court, if we think that you got it wrong, most of the times trial judges get it right, but if we think you got it wrong, we'll tell you and we'll tell you why. And it's not to substitute our judgment for yours, but it's to say, okay, we're a collegial court, we're all in this together, and we're going to tell you what we think is the right thing to do.
Thank you, Ms. Askins. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Gregory Weber, Assistant Attorney General representing the State of Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the Court. I am going to try to spend the first few minutes of my argument bringing some focus back to the issues that I believe are really before this Court and the issues that I think you have to resolve based on the issue that you granted review on. The State is asking this Court, the State came into this argument intending to ask this Court for three holdings. First, that Taylor's 18-year determinate sentence is not unduly harsh or unconscionable. Second, to ask this Court to not modify the standard of appellate review in the manner suggested by Taylor in his brief. Third, asking the Court not to abandon the independent review doctrine, again, as argued on brief by Mr. Taylor. And now I have to ask you for a fourth holding, not to adopt the standard for an excessive sentence that has been proposed by Mr. Taylor, frankly, for the first time in this oral argument. The Court, in granting the petition for review in this case, bracketed the issue as one of a review of the harshness or unconscionability of the sentence that was imposed in this case. With respect, I believe that Mr. Taylor's briefing in this case went well beyond that very narrow focus of the order granting the petition for review. We responded on brief, and I'm prepared to defend our position on brief. But I do think that this Court's focus should be on the individual sentence that was imposed in this case.
If I can ask you about that, Mr. Weber, if the focus is on the individual sentence, and I'm looking at McCleary and it talks in terms of sentencing according to the needs of the particular case as determined by the criminal degree of culpability and upon the mode of rehabilitation that appears to be of greatest efficacy, and then later in the McCleary decision, just because the legislature provides a range of 10 years, it would be nonsense to conclude that in a particular case it would make no difference in terms of legislative intent whether the sentence was for 1 year or 10. With that framework, is there a conflict between the Court of Appeals' decision in State v. Grindemann, which has a presumption that if it's within the range, it's okay and not unduly harsh, and the individualized sentencing that our State calls for based on McCleary and Gallion and based on what the legislature has stated?
I don't see an inconsistency specifically because this Court has always said that there is a presumption of correctness that attends a sentence, and that it is the responsibility of the defendant to show that there is some basis to complain legally about the sentence that's been imposed. Now, in between McCleary and Grindemann, we have O'Connor and a line of other cases that establish the standard for whether a sentence is unduly harsh or unconscionable. O'Connor was not a constitutional case, I don't think. It was a standard review of sentencing discretion case.
If I can focus on what you just said, though, there appears, at least in my mind, to be a difference between the presumption of correctness of the sentence where the defendant has to show how it's incorrect, which is consistent with this Court's longstanding position to try to avoid interfering with an individual judge's sentencing discretion. That's one thing. It's another thing to attach a presumption that if it's within the range, it's necessarily okay. Do you understand the qualitative difference that I see?
I understand the distinction as you see it. I guess I don't see that Grindemann, when it says we'll presume that a sentence within this particular range is valid, unless there is another reason to believe that it is not. I think that O'Connor and the framework of those cases give defendants, the State, and judges a framework to determine whether that presumption really applies in the case or not.
This is what I bring to the case. Now, I bring my experience as a circuit court judge where you see a lot. I bring my experience as a mother of four teenage kids and their friends where you see a lot. So, you know, I see in the statistics that are cited here, and I forget, but let's say current statistics are between around 35% or 40% of all high school kids have had intercourse.
Now 38 and change, I think.
Okay, so I'm right, between 35 and 40. And let me just hypothesize that not every one of those 38% have had intercourse only once. You know, that might be a wild hypothesis, but I don't think so.
I can fill that in for you if you want. From the original report from the morbidity and mortality folks, I think the percentage
is both.
One.
Listen, well, I think it is both.
Yeah, the percentage, and I'd have to check, but I think the percentage of high school age students who claimed to have had three or more acts of sexual intercourse was somewhere in the neighborhood of 3%. I don't vouch for it. I've got it.
Yeah.
in my briefcase.
Yeah, you know,
check if necessary.
The statistics are hard, obviously. At any rate, because you never know if they're bragging or minimizing, you know. But I look at these offenses. Now, as I understand it, correct me where I'm wrong on this. The first one is a 16-year-old, he's 16, she's 14, and I understand they both were charged or both had some kind of...
I don't recall specifically if she was charged, but I think the ages are right, and I defer to Ms. Askins on the facts.
And there were no were there any allegations of force or violence with regard to that? I mean, having intercourse with a 14-year-old is violence, but...
I don't believe that there were either specific allegations that it was physically forced, and I also don't think that there were any additional charges that were brought, which probably could have been brought if force had been applied, either battery or something under 942.25.
So you have a 16 and a 14-year-old, and I'm going to assume in that context, if it can be consensual, I'll use that term loosely because she's 14 years old, but I mean it wasn't forced. Then the next, and for that, if I recall, initially there was a probation of, let me think, about 2 years, 60 days confinement stayed.
I think that's right.
Okay. So no jail time but on probation. Then he has intercourse with a 17-year-old. Again, I understand the facts are what we would call consensual. Now, was he 16 or was he 17 when he had intercourse with this 17-year-old? Do you know?
I believe he was 17, but I am not sure. I suspect that that information is in the PSI.
So either they're essentially the same age or he might be. Okay. And there was some time consequence for that, if I recall. There was 60 days, then he had to serve.
There was either a revocation or an ALR, or an alternative to revocation.
And then we have this third one, and he's 18, and she is 15. Of course, he emphasizes almost 16, but she's still 15. Almost don't count.
Not here, no.
Yeah, that's right. And what bothers me are those ages. What bothers me, not that it isn't subject to criminal penalties, you know, but 18 years seems like an awfully lot.
Justice Bradley, what bothers me are the pregnancies. What bothers me is the activity to try and dissuade the victim in this case from testifying, from pressing charges. What bothers me is the serial nature of this man's behavior. What bothers me is the fact that, at least as based on his demeanor at sentencing and the observations of the author of the PSI, he just doesn't get it. Those things bother me. If the people of Wisconsin believe that it is in the best interests of society to somehow give a judge a limitation on the range of sentence that can be imposed based on the similarity of age between victim and perpetrator, there is a way to do that. They're called Romeo and Juliet laws.
Let me, so the law requires, as we said, we've said many times in McCleary and Settegord and Durrell is probably one of the main cases, that the court must impose the minimum amount of time consistent with the rehabilitative needs of the defendant, the protection of the public, and the severity of the offense. Can you point in the transcript? This was one of those transcripts where I read, and, you know, you got to the very end, and I didn't really have much of a clue what number was going to pop out. A lot of the transcript, or part of the transcript, was the conditions of probation, or the conditions once he was released that the PSI had indicated. So those, and at the very end, then came the sentence. And I didn't have a clue until that last paragraph if it was going to be 18 years or 12 years or 5 years. So can you explain from the sentencing transcript how the court followed Burrell and Settegord and McCleary with regard to imposing the minimum amount of time consistent with the protection, custody, and rehabilitation?
The court, unfortunately, didn't invoke that language. I'm not sure that any reviewing court in Wisconsin has specifically obliged a court to use the magic words. But from the transcript, I infer that this judge believed that this was an aggravated offense. I believe that this judge considered the minimum sentences to be grossly inappropriate. I think this judge believed that probation would have been a waste of time in this case, given the fact that Taylor failed at one attempt on probation. The term of confinement in this case, 12 years, actually falls within, if you divide the time available for the term of confinement from the 30-year sentence, it actually falls somewhere in the middle third. It's not in the area where we would call it a maximum or near maximum sentence. I think the court believed, and I think this is amply reflected in the sentencing transcript, the court believed that this particular defendant required incapacitation if he was to be rehabilitated.
Okay. I won't fight against that. I'm just wondering how he got the 18 years and how he came up with that in view of the court shall call, the sentence imposed shall call for the minimum amount of time cited in those cases. And I don't know how he came up with that.
And I'm forced, obviously, to argue from inference here because he did not specifically say, I find that 12 years of initial confinement is the minimum amount of time necessary.
And I'm not advocating that, because if I advocate that, then probably the other six justices would be on my back, so I won't advocate that. That's what we call, magic words, and no one wants magic words. But I want meaningful sentences. And there's nothing to me about 18 years given, you know, the first one, no time, the second one, 60 days, and then you go to 18 years. Now, I'm not saying it shouldn't be more. Than 60 days. I'm not saying you shouldn't go to prison. I'm just saying, where do you come up with 18 years? I mean, you know, do you take the guy's age and multiply it by 2?
Doubtful. And again, I see us as straying some from the issue that this court asked us to address, which was whether this sentence was unduly harsh and unconscionable. The standard for that is Okanis, and I'm prepared to address the alternative factors in Okanis.
Before you do that, can I just ask one question?
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you what effect you thought the pregnancies had, and then you really did answer it because you put that first. So I felt in this guy's a bad actor. 3 times, nasty at the sentencing, not smart enough at least to pretend. Really vulgar, shows absolutely no remorse, doesn't, as you keep saying, and Ms. Askin, dig it. Suppose that he had not impregnated these 3 young women, and that he just continues to engage in sexual behavior with young girls underage. You think it would have been 18 years?
I don't know. I think this judge probably, definitely the judge aggravated the sentences and considered it a more aggravated situation because of the pregnancies. Certainly sexual intercourse between adults and children creates all manner of difficulties, potential difficulties apart from pregnancy.
Yeah, but you still have this very small age difference. Suppose the judge had said, next time you're going to get, if you come before me, you're going to go to prison for a good long time, and you have to, you're going to put you on probation, but you have to agree no more children. Sort of Oakley.
as I'm trying to drum up the facts of Oakley in my head.
Oh, Oakley.
No, I remember the case. I remember the case.
You don't have to deal with Oakley. I'm just trying to say to you.
Let's not deal with Oakley.
I'm just trying to say to you that I think that to what extent should the pregnancies be such a big factor?
Well,
I mean, maybe yet you judge probably wouldn't be appropriate to say use condoms or birth control.
Well, and now we delve into the wonderful world of sentencing guidelines. This is not a guidelines case, by the way. I will say that immediately and up front. But if you go to the Wisconsin Sentencing Commission's website, you'll find a worksheet that is to be used for certain offenses occurring after, I think, July 1st of 05. And one of the indicators for type of harm is pregnancy or transmission of disease. The Sentencing Commission plainly feels that pregnancy is a sufficiently aggravating factor to include it in the judge's work with the worksheet.
I don't know how you deal with that. I don't know. I mean, one of the things that can occur is that young girls can get pressured into having abortions. And so I'm just not sure how that all plays out. I mean, if all three girls here would have had abortions, does that mean we're going to have less of a sentence?
No, I don't think so. I think what it does do is simply show that through his criminal conduct, through his sexual and criminal irresponsibility, this defendant put all three of his victims at substantial risk. Carry the pregnancy to term, incur the fiscal responsibilities of that, incur the possible detrimental effect to health, or terminate the pregnancy, which raises another series of health issues and involves an entire series of potentially ethical or spiritual concerns. I find myself coming back to the points that the sentencing judge in this case felt were in aggravation of the sentence. And it's the serial nature of what this guy did, combined with the very real-world consequences that he inflicted on his victims. And I think the sentencing judge in this case quite reasonably concluded that those were aggravating factors that took this case from one requiring or calling for a lesser sentence to a greater sentence, a greater term of incarceration necessary to incapacitate this guy. If he is going to be rehabilitated, it's not going to happen on the street. It's not going to happen with terms and conditions of probation that require him not to have sex. My guess is that his conditions of supervision when he was on paper probably involved him dealing either with his agent or refraining from certain activities, and we know how he did.
Mr. Weber, you were going to touch on the Okanis factors.
Once again, please.
You were going to touch on the Okanis factors?
Yes. By summary, the standard in Okanis, a sentence is excessive or unduly harsh if it is so excessive, unusual, or disproportionate to the offense committed so as to shock public sentiment and violate the judgment of reasonable people concerning what is right and proper under the circumstances.
And I want to talk about that once again because this is the one. There's two issues, as I see in this case, that are related to unduly harsh. One is the factual question, is it just too much? But the second is the legal question. And the legal question, for me at least, is this presumption that's floating around in Grindemann that really seems to suggest that, hey, as long as you're in the max, we're not going to second guess it. When McCleary and even O'Connor say, you've got to look at the particular facts of the circumstances. Now, I suspect you could defend the facts in this case under these circumstances. But the big picture, the legal issue is still out there for me in terms of this presumption, and should we be viewing this sentence through that lens?
Well, we come back to the earlier discussion that we had. I guess I interpret that presumption as being hand in hand with the general presumption of regularity in sentences. Whether we say we're going to presume that this sentence is valid or is not unduly harsh until the defendant gives us a reason not to, I don't see that as being fundamentally different from saying we presume that the circuit court's sentence in a case is appropriate until the defendant gives us reason to believe otherwise. And I think in Grindemann, the court actually, I mean, took that second step. The court said we're going to presume that the sentence is valid since it falls within the and I'm forgetting Grindemann if they use the exact language of Daniels, but the sentence falls within that range where the presumption would kick into effect. Does the defendant say anything to overcome that presumption? No. I think the defendant is in the same position that he or she would be in, even if in Grindemann they hadn't used the language of the presumption. If they just relied on the language in Daniels that says a sentence that that falls within the statutory range or the lower part of the statutory range will not be unduly harsh or unconscionable. And it's phrased, I believe it's phrased differently in different cases. But I think that Daniels...
Even the Daniels language, is that contrary to this notion of individualized sentencing, looking at the particular facts of a case, seeing if it fits within the guidelines of the minimum custody necessary to effect the purposes of sentencing? In other words, we're investing in the trial courts this discretion to call them as they see them in that case. When we review it, if we're not looking at what they review in that case because we're just assuming, hey, you're in the range, you're okay, is that a proper review for an appellate court?
I had not considered the difficulty in reconciling the presumption language in Grindemann to the generalized presumption of regularity in sentences. Frankly, I suspect, and as I say, I've not given it deep thought, but I suspect from the state's perspective, if we begin with the presumption of regularity and still oblige the defendant to show a reason why that sentence is not appropriate or is excessive or is an erroneous exercise of discretion, we probably are in the same place in terms of who has the varying responsibilities in a challenge to sentencing discretion. I want to think a bit about where you're taking me.
Counsel, in this case, we've listened to opposing counsel and some of the views or, let's say, questions asked from this bench. It would seem to me, and I just want you to talk about one of the goals is rehabilitation. It has to do with demeanor. It has to do with attitude. It has to do with, and this is a, we're talking about, as Justice Butler so aptly states, we're talking about individualized sentencing. And that's one of the, both the good and bad things of our system, because you can be on one end or the other. I think there's no doubt here that most of us would feel, well, maybe this is on one end or the other of this particular case. But as far as rehabilitation, I was looking through both the blue brief, the red brief, and the reply. I didn't see anything, and I know opposing counsel said 3 years. I'm not asking for you to pick a figure, but isn't that something that the judge at least here looked at, the rehabilitation and, I might say, the protection of the public when he pronounces sentence?
Oh, I believe it is something that a judge can look to, and I believe it's something that the judge looked to here. This defendant failed miserably at his first attempt at rehabilitation that didn't require him to be in a close confinement or in a prison environment. He failed miserably. His attitude, charitably, at sentencing could be called wretched, and we cited the remarks that he made at sentencing. I recognize the fact that Ms. Askins has an ongoing professional relationship with this man. I was a little twitchy when we started to talk about facts outside of the record, but I recognize the fact that she's obliged to respond to the questions that are asked. Do I have clear, current information from the institution about his potential for rehabilitation? No, I do not. I do not. I, like any other reviewing court, I believe, is required to look to the facts of record, and as the sentencing judge did, look to the facts of record to make his determinations about rehabilitative potential.
And that's what the judge had in front of him, was the looking at the rehabilitation and the protection of the public. He had to consider those things.
He had to consider those things in light of the defendant's conduct and what he, the judge, had seen up to that point. And I believe that when we review the record, what the judge had seen up to that point indicated that if this defendant is to be rehabilitated, it's going to happen in a corrections environment. It's not going to happen on the street.
Now, I just wanted to clarify one thing. In the pre-sentence, was that where it was called to the judge's attention that there was some type of intimidation or of the witness? Where did that come from? I'm not sure.
It's in the PSI.
Oh, it's in the PSI. All right. I think, okay. So that, there was nothing else other than the statement of the PSI. Was that in your?
Right. I refer to it at page 17
okay,
of my brief.
That's where I. Okay.
Yeah, first full paragraph, record 13-2.
Thank you.
What other remedies, if any, does the defendant have to reduce the sentence beyond a favorable ruling from this court?
Under truth in sentencing, a term of confinement is subject to reduction under a limited number of circumstances. He's not eligible for the challenge incarceration program. He's not a participant in the substance abuse program. If his medical condition is sufficiently grave or terminal, he would be able to obtain a modification of the bifurcated part of his sentence. That's section 302.113 sub 9G. And he would also, after service, I believe, of at least 25% of his sentence, he would be able to petition for sentence adjustment. The statute is section 973.195.
Did you say 25% was?
I'm not. The statute is 973.195. It specifies circumstances when someone can petition for sentence adjustment.
What class felony was this?
C.
And what was it reduced to?
If it's a B, then you've got some problems. You can't do some of that stuff.
Right. I believe. I thought it was a C. Was it a BC?
And I don't know the answer. That's why I asked the question.
And then was it ever reduced by the legislature?
Again, please.
Was it reduced by the legislature? That is, had he been convicted later, did the legislature ever reduce that sentence or that crime?
I don't think it reduced the sentence. I thought that it went up by 10 years. I think it's now 40.
Mr. Weber, let me ask, and I'm not sure how this plays in it, and I'm not sure it should play in it. I'm just trying to think of all the ramifications here in terms of this particular individual and this particular sentence. Assuming that he had been subject to a shorter sentence, or the trial court had given him a shorter sentence, I would assume that one of his responsibilities upon release would have been to undertake his responsibilities as a parent, provide child support for the children that are there, unless his rights were somehow terminated while he was incarcerated, and that he would have to then pay back for the cost of all the aid that had been provided to the state and things of that nature. By virtue of his incarceration for this period of time, he's obviously not in a position where that will happen. I would assume, although this may be an incorrect assumption, that in all likelihood his parental rights will be terminated and that these children will become subject to support from the state in large measure. Is this a factor that should, under these circumstances, where there is a non-violent, consensual, sexual relationship that takes place, are these factors that a sentencing court should look at or should not look at?
I think they're factors that a sentencing court could look at, and frankly, under the facts and circumstances of this case, I don't know if there were paternity adjudications that occurred with any of the victims in this case. I think you're right. I think that as a condition of supervised release, a court could probably order someone to participate in paternity adjudications. I do not know if there were termination of parental rights petitions filed in this case. I think in light of all of that, the court could consider those factors. I think the court also, though, owes a responsibility to society in general in terms of public protection. It may be that by placing this man in prison for this period of time, he would not be in a position to pay child support, although if there was some change in fiscal circumstances, possibly, I don't know. I think the court could consider those factors. In this case, I think other factors were paramount. I'm in the red.
Right. You know, we all know what that means.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Ms. Askins?
Just a couple factual things to the extent that the court is concerned. Again, this was a TIS-1 case. It was a BC felony, and I think Mr. Weber is right that when the penalties were reclassified that this became a B felony with a higher term of or a higher maximum term. And because of that, I believe that he would be eligible for a petition for sentence adjustment after serving 85% of the confinement. If I'm working from memory, but I think that's correct.
Even though as a BC?
Assuming there's another wrinkle, and that is that if my memory serves, this was one of those where the victim has a right to weigh in on a petition for sentence adjustment, but that goes down a whole other line of inquiry. In terms of the intimidation of the victim, page 2 of the pre-sentence report, if the court wishes to review it later, the girl came to the jail, Jermaine. let's see. When she left, Hollins, which was a third inmate, told the victim that Jermaine did not want her to show up to court as the charge would then be dropped. So just to clarify that. Now, picking up on the Grindemann standard, I would take the position that Grindemann conflicts with McCleary. And I say that because...
Also, can I just interrupt?
Sure.
Maybe I'm reading on page 15, red brief. It's that we're talking about the victim. She talks about her birth expenses. I have a medical card I've received with. And then she goes on to say that Taylor's assertion that SR, I'm reading this from the brief, it's on page 15, that SR did not view herself as a victim is belied by the record. SR's victim statement, I think he should be punished. I believe he will continue to do this. I believe he should be placed in prison for what he has done. What do you...
I think she does. I take from that she believes that he should be punished. I think she's very unhappy about what has happened to her. But that does not necessarily mean that she was coerced into this activity, if that's what the question is.
I wasn't inferring that.
Okay.
We even talked about
that. Okay. She clearly is a victim. She's clearly unhappy about what happened and that she would like him to be punished for that.
And she clearly was harmed.
She clearly was harmed by that.
Please finish.
And, go on, Josh.
Please finish your comments.
All right. In terms of Grindemann, the reason I say it conflicts is that Grindemann says any sentence well within the max is presumed correct, or words to that effect. McCleary says clearly it does matter whether the court sentences an individual to 1 year or 10 years when the maximum is 10 years. From that, I take it to mean that what this court said in McCleary is that it does matter, we do require an explanation, and just because it's well within the maximum doesn't mean the sentence is valid. I mean, if it's outside the maximum, it's an unlawful sentence. So it's got to mean something. And what I think it means is that the court, informed by the various standards and informed by a sense of justice and a sense of collegiality amongst the court, can determine whether a sentence is just or unjust.
But now, that has to pertain particularly to the facts of the case, right?
Not
just upon our view of whether or not we think it's good or bad.
Correct. It's got to depend on the record, which is why when it comes to the Galleon inquiry, why I argued in my brief that the reviewing court can say to the trial judge, look, I don't know how you came up with this number, and we're not going to try to figure that out anymore. We want you to explain to us how you came up with 18 years or 12 years or 5 years. And until you do that, we can't review your sentence. It's unmeaningful for us to review your sentence when we don't know how you got to that number. And so that's where the Galleon inquiry comes in. On top of that is the McCleary inquiry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Askin, and thank you, Mr. Weber, for once again appearing before us in a criminal case. And we will now call this hearing to an end. 2004 AP 1092 CR State versus Taylor. The court will meet in the conference room at 3 o'clock. That is adjourned until its next sitting for the December oral arguments.